Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast. And up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
Welcome to ModPath Chat, the official podcast of Modern Pathology, featuring interviews with authors and experts on the latest science, technology, and developments in the field of pathology. Your host, Dr. George Netto, is the editor-in-chief of Modern Pathology and the chair of pathology at the University of Alabama at Birmingham. Here's Dr. Netto.
Welcome to a new episode of ModPath Chat. Our guests today are two distinguished leaders in the space of digital and computational pathology. It's my great pleasure to be joined by Vipul Baxi, Senior Scientific Director of Digital Pathology at Bristol-Myers Squibb, and Michael Montalto, Chief Scientific Officer at Path AI. I look forward to hearing their thoughts on the promise of digital path and AI, and I'm sure the many challenges and opportunities that lay ahead. I refer you to their comprehensive open access recent review on the topic that was published in Modern Pathology. All authors' conflict of interest are listed in that manuscript. Thank you both for joining me today.
Thank you, Dr. Netto. It's a pleasure to be here, and thanks for having us.
Thank you, Dr. Netto. Yep, absolutely. A pleasure.
I really appreciate your taking the time, and this is a great review for those who are interested in learning more and more about the technology and how it works. And you start your review by explaining how really we're undergoing a revolutionary transition in our field from a qualitative, semi-quantitative at best, our human eye, the stuff that I and many in our field grew up with, to this, what's been dubbed the third revolution in pathology. We're moving really more precise, more quantitative, with the help of whole slide imaging and tools, computational path tools like AI. So with that in mind, maybe it's a good idea to start with what you beautifully depict in one of your figures, which is the workflow of a digital pathology when you're looking at a prognostic marker or biomarker. So you guys can decide who want to talk about what, and let's make it.
Vipul, maybe I'll let you start with that one. I think that was the figure you put together.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So again, I think we've definitely put in a lot of effort to put together this workflow that really allows us to quickly develop, test, train algorithms and scale these algorithms. So, you know, the way I've sort of bucketed it into these three categories for any digital pathology algorithm development effort, it all starts with having the right samples, having the right blocks, focusing on the particular stain of interest. It could be a standard H&E or a immunohistochemistry stain or a multiplex chromogenic or IF stain. But essentially starts with having the right samples, having the right representation of the phenotype that you're looking for in these samples to help train this. So if you're developing a simple tumor stroma algorithm or a cancer tumor cell detection algorithm, It starts with having the right sample sets to train these models. And so that's the sample preparation piece, and having your gold ground truth or your gold standard, which in our case, a lot of the algorithms that we develop pathologists are our ground truth. And so identifying what that ground truth is and generating that ground truth so that when you develop your algorithms, you can always compare it back to a ground truth here. And then comes the digital pathology piece, which is comprised of two things. It's the imaging piece and then the image analysis piece. So imaging, depending on the type of detection you're looking at, either a bright field a whole slice scanner or a immunofluorescence multispectral scanner. Mm-hmm. And there are multiple types of these scanners in the field that you can use. And then the second piece is the image analysis piece. So developing these algorithms, classify, so we can use standard image analysis techniques that we define the type of morphology of cells that we're trying to identify, or using some of the more advanced machine learning and AI approaches to train these based off of a lot of labeled data that we can get from pathologists to train these models. And then the last piece is how do we then deploy this in a scalable format? So once these algorithms are developed, validated, these can be packaged and deployed across large cohorts within almost a matter of minutes, if not faster, and you can generate high quality data minutes. Pretty quickly. For a single slide. Run this within a minute. So imagine, 1,000 samples. It can take pathologists, numbers of days to generate it.
Say months.
Yeah. An algorithm can do it pretty quickly. So that's the deployment of the algorithm across a large cohort, and then all the downstream data analysis, the bioinformatics piece of looking at efficacy to outcome, looking at correlation with other molecular data or genomic data, and so we can really expand the research with the quantitative data that you get here. So that's really the three buckets of the workflow that we have developed.
Beautiful. So simply, we have sample prep, and I like what you say, the ground truth. And at least for the time being, the pathologist's opinion remains the ground truth. Hopefully, not before I retire, that will always be the case till I retire. And then the second part is the imaging system, including the scanning and image analysis. And then the third bucket is the bioinformatics, the stuff that for most of us is beyond our not intelligence, but base of knowledge and training that we've had. So wonderful. And that's a great start. So clearly, while there is multitude of applications, you mentioned even H&E, standard H&E, and I'm always amazed by, now you call them computational biomarkers that just you extract from H&E that the human eye was not able to detect. But we'll leave that for another day. And maybe today we focus on clearly where we all hope it will help us a lot is IHC, be it, like you said, chromogenic, monoplex, multiplex, or spatial. Can you say a few words about that, both of you? What are the challenges and opportunities, and how realistic, or my worry when we talk about digital and computational is people feel we're talking about it, but really, are we using it yet? And hopefully that will come fast enough to validate this excitement, because a lot of time you're familiar with that in the field, a lot of excitement around something new that fizzles down the road. We're pretty sure that this is not going to fizzle. This is a true revolution. But can you tell us what should we expect, timelines, challenges, where do we head with both of you being such leaders in the industry and interacting a lot with academics, places and investigators like other pathologists do?
Yeah, I mean, I think the question is when can we expect this to reach clinical practice, maybe, and impact, patient decisions, which is really what pathology is all about at the end of the day. So, I mean, there's almost, unfortunately, there's not a simple answer to that. I mean, some would say it's there today. So there are institutions like the great work that's happening at Ohio State and UPMC and other places across the country where the investments have been made and digital pathology is being established, and people are starting to use it in their everyday practice for various different reasons, whether it's improving workflows, primarily probably in working workflows and efficiencies. And that now we're seeing AI-based algorithms like the Page AI prostate tool that was recently cleared by the FDA to potentially be used in screening for prostate cancer. So those are available today. They're not necessarily, I think your question is a good one in that when will it be widespread use and when will everybody be using it? And I think that's still an open question. I still think that the industry is struggling a little bit with how will this technology best serve patients in the end of the day. You talked a little bit about IHC as an example, where we know there's a lot of inter-reader variability for things like tumor or immune cell scoring for PD-L1. I think David Rimm just had a great paper recently in JAMA Oncology about HER2 low and the challenges at HER2 low. And we're seeing drugs approved for that indication. So will patients be accurately classified with IHC tests that are coming out more recently, like PD-L1 or like HER2 low? And I think we've got data that suggests that not really, that inter-reader variability is going to present a challenge in terms of meeting patients' demands, meeting the right sort of therapeutic approaches for these patients. So one could imagine that a test could be available for an AI-based test to classify patients for IHC for these new therapeutics that are coming around. And that would be better serve those patients. How is that going to happen? I think this is a good question. And Vipul, we can talk a little bit about this. And Dr. Netto, you can weigh in on this as well. Will, in the way IHC is very routinely used across many different labs, will we expect AI to be used in the same way? Or would we expect it to be used more in the way that NGS is being used, which is in major testing centers and with a send-out model, where you're still where clinical decisions are still being made, but not every lab in the country or globally is able to run an NGS test because the technology is expensive. It requires very sophisticated knowledge. So I think
we're a significant investment. I mean,
we're significant investment. That's right. That's right.
So even in a big academic center like UAB, it's not something we just decide overnight.
That's right. I think we're at a crossroads as an industry. I think that we have to, the best way that I can get people to think about this is to think of the two major value propositions in two major buckets, so to speak. So one is efficiency and workflow. That can be gained in any lab or institution. Mm-hmm. And you have to determine how much value you're getting from that versus the investments you need to make. The other bucket would be, I think, precision medicine testing, which happens at a much lower rate compared to the totality of pathology, but it's very high value. Patient decisions are made based on that precision medicine-based testing. And in the latter bucket, you don't have it widespread use. You have it at very specialized institutions. I think, when we talk about will it be available today, I'm of the mindset, and I think a lot of the review that Vipul and I and others authored here was around the precision medicine testing component, that is, while the technology is here and we can show the proof point, it needs to start to get out into some testing centers, and I even think pharma companies need to invest in the distribution in various testing centers to begin to set up more of a testing center like model in the way that Foundation Medicine pioneered in the early, it's funny to say the early days of NGS because it really that was about 10 years ago, but there were early days in NGS where Foundation had to create that model. And then other institutions began to offer it. So I think we're on the kind of cusp on that. I don't know, Vipul, what you would think.
Before Vipul, I mean, weigh in. So you raise an interesting point. And basically, would this be in a reference setting? And it's not a fear, but it's a strong possibility that if they become the companion testing, which for a lot of time right now it's a PDL that we can try to do in different academic centers without major investments, but NGSs and like you said, whole exome or what have you, like TMBs, those if those became the companion testing and the companion testing lock us in AI for even a monochromic, right? Or a monoplex, you can see where that become a problem. I haven't thought about that, but
yeah, exactly.
Hopefully it's not an all or none where we have to send out.
Oh my gosh, I love that you said that. So I just gave a talk this morning with Anil Parwani, actually, at the Precision Medicine Leader Summit. And we talked about this point very specifically. And one can imagine a hybrid approach, a hybrid distribution model or a commercialization model, where the assay testing is done as it's done today. Let's say a new test comes out. Let's say Vipul and I are widely successful and we develop a new CD8-based test for selecting patients. One can imagine that the chemistry version of that is done as it is today in any lab. And so you can get technical component fees for doing the lab testing, but then the slides are sent out to a place like PathAI or other labs where they scan it and provide back to you at your institution the test result, which you open up, you review visually, you kind of confirm the algorithm result, and then you also bill for the professional component because you've done that part. The only part that you haven't done is get the slide scanned and press the button to get the result back. Now, if you have your own slide scanner, maybe you scan it and press the button. But if you don't, you send the slide just like you would send something to Foundation. So I think we can live in both worlds. The beauty of cloud-based computing is that if you have a scanner, perhaps you can upload it to the cloud. If you don't, you can send the slide and still gain the benefit of reviewing the test results yourself remotely. So that's
and possible. I think it's encouraging, at least at this point, understanding that different scanner platforms, there is somewhat of a universality of the file that you can do that. So it's not taken for people with places with less ability to make serious investment. At least they do that part. Yeah. Very, very interesting. It's really a revolution. There'll be a lot of moving pieces. Vipul, I didn't mean
that's fine. One thing I'll say in addition to what Mike said is I think we're also at a point where a lot of what we're doing right now is also somewhat trying to mimic what a pathologist is doing, just to get the comfort level there of what digital pathology can do. But I think when the point where we will really start making a big difference is when we start doing things, where we're able to identify features or things that are just pathologists can't do visually. And that will, I think, take us over that bar. And at that point, pathologists obviously can be the ground truth for that. But response data, other data may become the ground truth rather than the pathologist once we cross that threshold. And I think that is also what's going to really drive digital pathology into this type of NGS-like testing where we're just routinely doing.
Very, very good. I think even if we think about the early days of molecular and PCR testing for targeted therapies, and now NGS testing, which is essentially recapitulating targeted therapies in a panel-based setting, it really was the pharmaceutical industry that drove the need, the clinical adoption, the clinical necessity to identify patients, even in early molecular days, now in NGS days. And I think Vipul probably shares this. You know, we have a strong hypothesis that pharma will too drive the necessity of AI-based digital pathology precision medicine testing, which is a little bit separate. Yeah, a little bit separate than just standard digital pathology that we talk about broadly. Yeah.
Yeah, and I mean, clearly you hit exactly on the point. Nobody is talking about, the idea is not just to scan and use computer screen and TV rather than microscope. That's going to be common, and that's going to be actually also operator dependent. Some people would never leave the scope, and we're undergoing that transition here. But we're talking about the added value, the precision medicine part that we see it really where the value is. And I think, Vipul, you bring an important point and maybe can be a segue to our next question, which is, so the ground truth so far is the pathologist, as we spoke, and meaning I will be annotating if I'm lucky and you say, George, let's start an algorithm together on prostate cancer or bladder cancer. So I'll be looking at these slides and telling you my thoughts, and that's going to be the ground truth, and we'll take it from there. But the next step is what you're saying, where the money is. The ground truth is, how did the patient do? And taking the pathologist annotation out of the mix, hopefully not completely. So is that, can you talk about that machine learning versus deep learning and explain?
Yeah,
that.
Absolutely. So I don't foresee there being zero pathologist involvement. I think there's definitely different ways of looking at how we train the data and how we implement that data, right? So from a training perspective, when we talk about machine learning and deep learning, just to take a step back, you know, standard machine learning, and we've been using machine learning for some time now, where it's a way of essentially developing algorithms, but knowing what you're looking for and knowing what you want to measure, and developing these type of machine learning models that are targeted to that. Whereas when we shift over to deep learning based approaches, essentially we don't need to know, or we don't need to know what it needs to look like, or give an example. If we're trying to detect tumor cells, I don't need to know what a tumor cell looks like, as long as I can get enough pathologists to train, provide enough labels, image labels of what a tumor cell looks like, a deep learning model will figure it out. Whereas a machine learning model, I would need to, you know, at least have some prior features of what a tumor cell looks like to be able to train the model. So that's essentially where that difference is. But even going into the ground truth aspect of things, you know, we'll still need pathologists to train sort of these interpretable models to some extent. But then how that model integrates with all the features that get generated, how these features are combined into it, and then a subsequent model that can help us predict response, that may be a level that that we may not have a ground truth for pathologists, but that's where response becomes the ground truth. So, you know, looking at, you know, we may need pathologists to help us train a model to identify lymphocytes. But once we have done that and we know where all the lymphocytes are in the tumor microenvironment, then we can build a model on top of that to see, okay, this is the kind of pattern of lymphocytes that can help us predict a response. And that is something that we don't need a pathologist ground truth for.
And that's almost like a discovery, right? It's not, mm-hmm. It's kind of like targeted NGS. So you're knowing exactly what versus whole genome, and
that's right.
You don't know what you're looking for. And very, very interesting. But it's kind of, you'd say, we will still have a role, because at least you have to say it at this stage.
And there's one, actually, can I add to that as well, Dr. Netto? I think not. So certainly we'll have a role in training, as Vipul is sort of indicating, you know, doing the initial labeling at the level of like cells and tissue, and then we can look at outcomes. In discussions we've had with regulatory agencies recently around this type of technology, it's still important that a pathologist be involved in the very end of the process as well. That is to say that the test result worked. Let's take Vipul's example to an extreme, where we have lymphocytes in certain patterns that a machine identified. We didn't have a human identify it. And then we wanted to make that test available, and we go through the regulatory agencies. The agencies still, and I think we all feel this way, want a human being to oversee the test, want to have some sort of quality control that indeed that is a lymphocyte, indeed that is the right tissue type, indeed the staining did look good enough. Maybe I can't identify the exact thing that the computer is giving us a result on, but I have some oversight to identify these edge cases and these problems that can be really anomalies down the road. So I think, I hope that the listeners who may be new to this space don't envision a future anytime soon where it's literally a computer with no human involvement at all. I think that is not how even the highest, complexity precision medicine testing is going to happen. We, in fact, even today, we still have humans looking at the quality controls and NGS testing and variant calling, and we make sure that it's accurate. We'll have to have the same part of that, I think, for AI and pathology.
I guess an analogy that is more consistent with the current news is the phantom brake of driverless self-driving cars, right?
Yes.
You still want somebody around that behind the steering wheel,
similar.
And at least you still want a steering wheel.
That's right. Yeah, I think that's a good analogy. I think that's probably accurate to how this will unfold.
Well, wonderful. So let's finish up. Enjoy the conversation, but due to the time, where do you think we're heading in terms of like, I know there's a lot of talk about spatial, about TME, especially in the PDL. Pearls you can offer our audience what to expect and how where we're heading in that regard, especially in immune therapy.
I think one of the big drivers in the recent explosion in this work is IO therapy, tumor microenvironment testing, and there's many we've published even collaboratively with Vipul and his team. Work that shows subtleties in the tumor microenvironment pre and post treatment can predict, outcome and things like that. So I think we'll just out of H&E and others in IHC, and then the high complexity multiplex immunostaining, I think is also showing us that there's a lot of value to be gained in predicting patient response and selecting the right kind of therapy. So where we are, I think right now is, and again, I think the point of this review to some extent, and the reason it was written by industry was to show just how this is being used in the context of drug development. And right now it is being used, I think, in exploratory phases, retrospective, it's on the cusp, if not already being used in prospective validations, which is the next step. And then from there, we may even start to see some potential approvals where this is going to be used clinically. I'm very optimistic that in sometime soon, we'll begin to see the benefits from this clinically. I don't know, Vipul, what you think about that?
Yeah, I'll quickly add. I think the very optimistic, and what we have seen so far is, at least the algorithm, the AI algorithms are actually empowering some of these IRC technologies to get even better and better. More complex, more markers on the same slide, and both I think are playing off of each other, the staining technologies and the image analysis technology. So I think we'll continue to see the evolution of these technologies get better and better, more consistent, more stable staining of these multiplex markers. And I think what the other thing that we'll see is we're going to get a point where imaging will just become a standard. What we have seen at least up until now is, digitizing slides was always an afterthought. And I think what we're getting towards is now just more standard and good quality imaging, so that we can use, we can train our models moving forward with better quality data than what we have from maybe 5 years ago or 10 years ago that we're using. Yeah.
And just to put a finer point too on where we are today, many listeners may not know this, but there is a test available through now Castle Biosciences, but it was pioneered through Cernostics, which is a digital based multiplexing test, which predicts risk from Barrett's esophagus to risk of developing esophageal cancer from Barrett's esophagus, which is a large unmet medical need. And it's available now by send out in a reference laboratory setting. It's not making as much press as maybe Foundation did in the days of TMB, but it's there today. And they're starting to seek reimbursement. They're starting to see adoption in GI clinics as a result of it. So it's that close to us today already. And I could see more of this starting to evolve over time.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned reimbursement, because that's going to be an extremely important piece that we struggled with for the longest time, especially with NGS, and it's been delaying the progress and deployment in a lot of places. So hopefully we learned some lessons there and make the value propositions to third-party payers that this is investment upfront that will pay off for outcome and savings on wrong therapies and wrong patient selection. Well, I think we need to do another podcast on this. You guys have been terrific hosts, terrific guests, and I really enjoyed it, and I'm sure our audience will too. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Any opinions expressed in this podcast are the speaker's own and do not represent the views of Modern Pathology, Springer Nature, UAB, or USCAP. Your ModPath Chat host and scientific director is Dr. George Netto. Producers are Christina Crow, Amber Jackson, Dr. Sarah Jang, and Dr. Catherine Ketchum. Technical direction is provided by Kaminsky Productions, music by Mitch Neubauer. Thanks to the authors, reviewers, and editors of Modern Pathology for making this podcast possible.